Accession number 17731, Reel 2.
Mr. Mark, Reel 2.
Thank you. At 4 o'clock that afternoon, company commander ordered my section back to that nunnery, as I call it. They were equally as nice, and they got these birds killed, plucked, and they're frying them, cooking them, stewing them, doing everything to them, and there wasn't a pigeon there. And we had several trips like that around these places in the next few days. But, of course, on May the 10th, we went over the border into Belgium.
But it sounds as though the nuns didn't resent...
No, they were lovely people. They were extremely nice. They were frightened. They'd never seen an English soldier, I don't suppose, and... They were young, they were delightful. The Mother Superior that spoke to me was a delightful woman. And I suppose, sorry to butt in, I do suppose that all Frenchmen, because later on, a few months later in my life, I met a French woman who, I will explain it later on about that lovely old lady, at Armentières. Later, when we were ordered back to Dunkirk. But on May the 10th, we went over the border. We marched to a town called Courtrai, where it had been bombed. Their air force consisted of a few biplanes which had been shot to pieces on the ground, which was grass, runways. The town was lovely. Belgium being absolutely rebuilt after the 14 war. It had sewers, lovely little boxes called bungalows, and it was a delightful, clean place. The people lined the streets and gave us cakes, flowers, pointed up the road, shouting and laughing, Berlin. Just one of those things that people hope for. But it didn't come to be at that particular time. And we went to a place, and this is where my memory might be at fault. Out of Courtrai, we marched towards, in the distance of some long way, mile, Brussels. Well, I never got, my regiment never got to the Elbert Canal. It was just up in front of us, never saw it. And we were stationed at a place called, when I say stationed, we dug in, ready to fight. At a place called Oudenaarde. And unfortunately, experience didn't tell. My platoon dug in a cemetery. Huge. And evidently Belgium and French tombstones go nearly up to the clouds. And when the Germans shelled us, they lobbed them in amongst those tombstones. And I got caught in the back of my pack, on my back, with a lump of granite. It bowled me over. I thought I was dead. Painful. And from that moment on, the word retreat was never used in my hearing. It always had to be an orderly withdrawal. Same thing. Different name. The army didn't retreat. And we went back to a little farm where I linked up. We'd already got scattered here and there. Linked up with another platoon under the directions of a Lieutenant Salmon, God bless him, who died in the desert at El Alamein. And we dug in. There was an artillery mob there. With one gun, an 18-pounder, that's a little tiny thing, no more than 4 foot off the ground on two pneumatic wheels, 18-pounder. They never fired the thing, they never had chance. Because one morning, we were only there in the evening, and one morning there were these men walking through the trees. And I do remember this. Lieutenant Salmon was a great friend of mine, and he ordered us to lie along this ditch and wipe those guys out with rifle fire. And I said to him, don't you think that if we do that, there's so many of them in that woods, they'd just knock this farm and us, it'll be the end of us too. And he thought about it, and we had another orderly withdrawal down the line where one of our members, and this might not be quite accurate, a private soldier in that platoon by the name of Gardner, who lived in Farnham, and I believe he was an ex-gypsy, and I rather think, as he come over a five-barred gate down that lane, a parson shot him in the eye. A man dressed as a parson. I might not be quite right about that fact of the man being dressed as a parson, but that's what they said had happened to Gardner, a boy by the nickname of Mivy Gardner. And that's the last I knew, but I understand he got away and he lived. I've never met him since at any reunion, always looked for him. But from that time on, it was a steady rout. And somewhere along the line, Lord Gort himself, over the radio, in a 1,500-weight truck, we heard him say, and once again, I might not be 100% accurate, every man for himself, back to Dunkirk. Now, that was a good many miles away. I'm still with a few Queen's men and Lieutenant Salmon, where we pinch, that's the word, we stole a vehicle, a 3-ton Austin covered, loaded it with petrol, plenty of other deserted vehicles, red cans of petrol, and got in it until we couldn't go anymore because of all those refugees crowding the road. So we took to the country with this thing, and we kept it, and we came to a place that I'd heard of, Passchendaele. Don't know whether it was a town. I don't know what it was, but there was a main straight road, and all the houses were burning each side, and there was all our transport, some burning, some not, where we pinched all the petrol we could come across, loaded it everywhere, filled the tank to overflowing, chucked the rest inside, and went across the fields. And we kept going like that. We got stukered. They deliberately shot at us, going across an open field where only our Oskin 3-tonner was there, and he thought it was fun to shoot us up. And I only hope that that man met a Spitfire pilot who might have showed him the way to shoot, because he didn't even put one round through the canvas. He did not do it. He knocked the mud over us, but he didn't get too close. And we carried on. And 15 miles outside of Dunkirk, thanks to Lieutenant Salmon, we pulled in at a farm, and I'm scared. And the farmer's wife gave us, because we had no money, we gave what we did have, eggs and chips, dirt earths, they called it. And we sit down in this field, and we got halfway through those eggs and chips, and mortar bombs landed in the field. So everybody up, we're scared stiff, we couldn't see the enemy, didn't think they were there, but they could have been, evidently, they were all around. We didn't know where that come from, never saw a German, but they lobbed them in. Range of those mortars, 1,500 yards, so somebody had to be a bit close. So we jumps in our wagon, and away we went. And at 15 miles outside of Dunkirk, law and order took place. Yeah, it did. In a field with all that British transport, hundreds, thousands of every description of motor vehicle belonging to the British Army was there, and they were putting bullets through the engine block, and they took our 3-tonner away and told us we had a walk. And they said, it's 15 miles to the beach, get yourselves there. And we were being stukered, the field was being stukered, although the Germans didn't intend blowing that transport up. No way. They didn't fire into that compound. Acres of them. And they took everything away, and we had a march. And we marched. And I don't know how many days to do that 15 mile of jumping in and out of ditches as they came over. And eventually, I got to Dunkirk. Totally lost. On my own. The reason for that being, there were so many men coming down all roads to get to the beach. you got pushed and shoved and you got parted and you got lost, but they're all British, so you're happy. And I eventually got to Dunkirk on my own, where I met some more Queen's men of my own company. And we stayed together for some time. We were all scared. There was no Navy. No Navy. There was a big French cruiser, I suppose, out there. And it did nothing. It never fired. It continually turned its guns, its big guns, pointing at the beach. And that was frightening. And I couldn't understand. Never knew what that boat did. It stayed there for one solid day, and the Germans never hit it, as far as I ever saw. And there was everything out to sea burning, all sorts of shipping, and the mole was being. And I found out that I had hit the beach at La Pang. That's about 3 miles up from that mole. And we couldn't get off, and we seemed to drift to park. And once again, I decided that to get back in their sand dunes, and you dug a hole with your steel helmet to get a little bit lower. And they stukered us. They did everything to us. They bombed us. And one day they shelled us, and that was terrible. Long range, I suppose 15 mile outside of Dunkirk. That's where they were. I didn't know what stopped them, why they didn't come in, but they didn't. And we didn't have any news or anything. We didn't know what was going on. It was complete chaos. The Air Force doing their bit. By God, they did their bit. And really and truly, it wasn't long before the Air Force, God bless them. Well, they took command of those beaches, and anything that come down, a Stuka was no match for them. And they didn't come. They stayed away, one or two Messerschmitts. But they left us alone for a bit. We used to get the occasional bombing and things like shoot up as one flashed through. But he was soon pounced upon. And the RAF dropped petrol cans of water on the beach, but it injured so many people that it seemed to me that they stopped that. And I remember battering my way through a window of an estaminet in Dunkirk, because there was a line of bottles on the shelf I could see through. And I got in and got myself a bottle of wine or two. But when I got in, all I had to do really was to have walked round the side of that building. I could have walked in without battering my way in with a rifle, but because it was all blown to pieces. But these bottles was okay. And I went back and sat in the sand dunes. Nothing to eat. Not hungry. I wasn't hungry. But boy God, I was thirsty. And I kept having a swig from this red wine. And the beach, it up and down it. And I sat there thinking, frightened. Yep, frightened is the word. Scared. There was nothing we could hit back with. We had nothing. Every time a Stuka come over, all them thousands of rifles on the beach shot at him, but I didn't see anybody shot down. Because rifle fire is highly dangerous to a pilot up there, especially when it's in numbers like that. Somebody's going to get close to him, but I didn't see one get shot down. But I sat in that sand dune on my own, right at the very end, and thousands upon thousands of men in the beach, and there is no Navy. No, nothing. And nobody's getting off. Some men had little rowboats and were going to row across. The sea was like a mirror. It was beautiful. It was shallow at the front and very, very deep a little way out. And a young bloke come and sat side of me, and he said, "Have you got anything to drink?" I said, "I got a bottle of wine, and I got another bottle buried in the sand." It was May, end of May, the weather was red hot, beautiful sun, and I'd put it down in the damp sand and I was keeping my bottle cool, I knew that. And I drew it out and he had a drink and I looked at him and he was a one pipper, a lieutenant uniform, all bedraggled. Only young, my age, 20-ish. Royal Corps signals. And he said, I got a biscuit, an army biscuit. And with my bayonet, the handle of, we cracked that. I don't know how you're meant to eat it. It was like cement, but it eventually keeps you going. We shared a biscuit. And we laid back to keep out of the way of everything and wait. There was nothing else to do. And he suddenly shot up in the air and he's looking up in the sky, a beautiful blue sky. And he looked round at me and he said, grab that bunch of fellas over there, get them over here, he shouted too, and lift this 1,500 weight truck up by the nose. That man up there, he said, I don't know what plane it is, but he's signalling. And if I think it's right, by God, he said, get that 1,500 weight truck pointing over there. And they manhandled it round, and the front wheels and was on a bloke's shoulders, 8 or 9 of them, all round, holding it up. And he got in, and with the lights, the headlights, he's flashing it back. And that fella up there's doing the same thing. Didn't mean a thing to me, didn't mean a thing. And he said, whoever that guy is up there, it's a Lysander. He said, and he's not going to hang around. He's done what he had to do. He said so. And he said, the bloody Navy's coming. They'll be here at 4 o'clock. Nobody believed it. We looked up in the sky and that thing had gone. Don't know where he went, but he went home. And God bless him. I sat there with that man at 4 o'clock, all them black marks on the horizon, all the way. And it had to be smoke. And they came in, didn't they? The big stuff come in that deep water out there. And they turned their noses like that. The sterns were, I'd never seen ships like it. But they're ours. They're the Royal Navy. And they're big broadcasting trumpets. Keep calm, keep calm. We are going to fire. They kept repeating that. Keep calm, we are going to fire. They lined up, stem to stern, all along. Huge things out in the deep water. And I saw the guns come round, and then they went up, then they come down, and everybody said they're getting on target. Their target had to be that 15 mile away that's shelling the beaches periodically. And by God, they opened fire. You could smell the cordite. My tin hat went up in the air together with thousands of others. And you go over and over. The pressure of that air, just at once. And it all finished. I thought the end of the world had come. And I couldn't stand still. I suffered today. And I'm treated today. But I was bleeding from the mouth. And I thought I'd lost my face or something. You think of all dreadful things on for a second. But evidently I had bitten my tongue. And it was bleeding profusely, but it healed. And then all of a sudden, all these little boats come into the water's edge. And it was orderly. Men obeyed whoever was given them orders. And they got in and the boats went back. And that went on, and more boats come in, and we're getting down to the water's edge, and there's a guy coming in with a motorboat, and he grounds it into the sand just in front of me. And his first words were, hello, fellas, is everything all right? Have you seen my son? That's what he said, out of all them thousands. And we said, no, no way, Gov. That's all right, get in, fellas. Well, he took his number and went off. I'm still on the beach. You couldn't get in. The queues were so long. So we drifted along to the mole. I'd lost that signals officer. He like everybody else. And then suddenly along comes an officer. Can't remember his name. I should do, but I can't. He gathered a few of us together and we marched to the mole. And because we had an officer, we could get on. Now we got to the mole and there were a lot of people crowded round, and we were taking our turn. The mole had been hit. People had put plank across this darn great gap in the mole. And there was all these boats tied up, including destroyers, alongside, three of them, in line from the jetty, out like that. And there was a naval officer, lots of gold braid, standing at the foot of the mole. And he was telling soldiers to throw their rifle in the water. It's weight we can't take. And soldiers were doing that, and that didn't appeal to me. I couldn't understand. I'm taking my rod home. And I never parted with it. He made no attempt to stop anybody taking their rifle, but he was saying it, and men were obeying this naval officer, whoever he might have been. God knows who he was. Don't ever know whether he was English or a mixture of Fifth Column. We never knew. But rifles were going to be in short supply. Had to come in from America later, didn't they? Old things. I bought mine home, so did a good many more. But when they got to the first boat on the mole, and you had to run, because the Stukas come out the sun, and when they went that way, you run, because they hadn't got time to make the circle and come back. And you run. We got over the plank, and a Matt Lowe, a sailor, said, "Over the rail, fella." So he gets over the rail in a hurry, scrambling like hell to get on board this destroyer, which was level. But he didn't stop there. He said, "Over the other rail," another sailor. "Over there, there's two rails then of another ship. Join together." So we clamber over here. That's two destroyers and another gunboat. And when we got to the other rail over the other side, the width of this room, probably a little more, I can't remember. Over that rail there, and Matt Lowe said, "Jump." And I look down, and there's an air sea rescue launch down there, 20 feet. And I said, "No." He said, "Go on, jump if you want to go home." And with that, he gave me a kick up the backside, and I went over. And I landed on this air sea rescue launch, together with others, like flies we fell on there. Nobody hurt, but the poor man up front, I do remember him. I don't know what his rank was. He's in the Air Force. And he's proud of it. He's got an open thing. And they got an AK-AK gun screwed to the floor at the back. All round the superstructure are things like 303 bullets, only a yard high. That round, shells, with just like a 303 bullet, clipped all around there, see? And it's luckily, I'm there, aren't I, near the surround of the woodwork. And he's shouting like hell with a little megaphone, "For some of you bees," he said, "get round the other side or we'll turn over." And that's enough, he said. Got a load to people up the top, and he's going to move out. And he didn't warn anybody anything. He just started that engine. And we went out past the mole. You'd think you were on the River Thames. There were no waves, and it was as calm and glassy. And we gradually and very slowly he took it out to the end of that pier, and then all of a sudden he opened it up and the front lifted out and we all slid. You bumped into somebody else, and there was a pole, thick as my thumb, steel pole with wire round the edge, and it's coming towards me. It went straight between my legs and I'm hanging on. And it's we came over at speed. What a beautiful little thing it was. Air Sea Rescue with the brig Air Force rings on the side, he'd had. But this gun at the back, he shouts, don't he, from the bridge, because the Stukas are coming. We're only just clear of the mole. And "Pass them up to him," he said. And infantryman, I didn't know nothing about things clipped to the... But anyway, you soon learn. I pulled them out, didn't I? And the bloke up there grabbed them, shoved them in the hole, did something to the gun, it went bang in a cloud up there. This is the God's truth. That LAC, I suppose he was, didn't have any rank firing this gun. And constantly the fella on the little bridge in the open kept turning round saying, "I told you before, don't shoot over the bloody bridge." And all in panic, I'm snatching these out. Because every time he fired, he opened the thing. And these red hot shells are going down. And some went over the side. And because this man on the bridge turned now, "Don't let them go over. We got to take them back. They're solid brass. Now wake up, don't you? We've been fighting for days. Tired, some of them asleep, but They were grabbing these red hot shells. I was blistered, my thing. And the bloke up there, come on, come on. And some come out the rack all right and some didn't. And some guy gets up and gives you a hand and you look at this damn thing and he shoved it up the hole and little old muzzle with a wheelie come round, he fired it, went bang and a wing come off of a Stuka. And I watched it, didn't I? And it's going round and round like that, a wing out to our side. And it hits the water. And then you look for the plane and he's at the deck out to sea. And I never seen such firing in my life from the beach. Every rifle come down on that Stuka out. That man could have never gone home. God bless him, maybe he's taken care of. But he didn't go home, that man. He couldn't have. He couldn't get away with it. The beach exploded with rifle fire. And we come in, and we came in to Dover. We waited for the tide to get this little boat up level, and the trains were waiting right there. And somebody said to me, Marty boy, you got to step off with the right foot. It's unlucky to put the left foot on first. So you're on this little platform. We were level with the ground, the deck was, so we had no jumping with this thing. And there's the trains, and they said, railway people said, righto, this one here, in here all you blokes. Blokes were crowding into these coaches, steam engines all whistling and, yeah. And I got in and I got myself a window seat, prompt, set down. And a porter went by and I said, here, have you any idea where this thing's going? No, mate, he said, we never know, but this one's due to go north. And I sank back there and I thought, I don't know. And just the width of this room is a platform, there's another train standing there, empty. They're waiting for the next lot coming in to put them in there and get them off the, out the way. And that started to happen, and I thought, I got nothing to lose. If that bloke's right, I ain't going north. I want to go south. I got nothing to lose, so I got out of that train, run across, quite breaking the law, got in the train, got myself a seat. It filled up, they moved it out. I fell asleep, and this is the gospel truth. I don't know how long I had slept. I was tired. But there was a lot of noise going on, a screeching of brakes, a clanging of everything, and it's evidently coming to a stop. And I opened one bleary eye and I looked up and God almighty, it said Guildford. And it stopped. And I'm up, aren't I? And all the red caps along the platform, helping more than anything else, helping. Brilliant guys. And I got my shoulders out of this here. I'd let that strap down all, but the doors was locked. And I got my body half out, and I'm going home. And a red cap said, sorry, fella. Nobody gets out. And he shoves me back in. He said, where do you live? I said, I live at Whitley. And I'm going home, mate. He said, nobody leaves, fella. Get yourself, take your cup of tea when the woman come round. And a little old lady said to me, where do you live? Milford. No, Whitley, I said. And she said, I said, before she answered me, let my mum and dad know that I got away. And she has these postcards. She tell me the address. I told her the address, and that's all I saw. Somebody thrust a mug of tea at me. Some woman gave me an apple, and somebody stuck a cigarette in my mouth, which seemed to be all at one time. And eventually, we passed out the cups and things and said goodbye.